open our Rules Committee today, our interim committee on rules. And I think the first thing to do, we have a few new members, just a short explanation and introduction of each of our members and our wonderful staff. So with that, we'll start over to my right or left.
Your left. I'm the new member, I suppose.
Well, we can go with Mr. Reed. He can get it started, so he can introduce you then after that.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'm Tobias Reed, State Representative from District 27, Beaverton, and pieces of Southwest Portland and unincorporated Washington County and a little Multnomah County as well. Happy to continue serving on the Rules Committee. We're just commenting about the varied nature of things that come before this committee and enjoy the ongoing education.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
It's my understanding that there's been significant changes in Representative Reed's life since the last time I saw him, and I think congratulations are in order.
Thank you. Thank you. I think those congratulations should go to Heidi and to our daughter Annika. I was, you know, there, but playing but a small role.
You look more rested than I would have anticipated.
Believe me,
you might want to turn off your cell phones if you haven't.
Since I haven't.
I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Mazel tov. Yeah.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Bruce Hanna, State Representative, District 7, vast portions of Douglas and Lane counties. Glad to be with you all.
Happy to have you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. State Representative Bob Jensen from the great Pendleton country, Umatilla County, House District 58. We have just concluded the greatest show on earth, and coming in just a little less than a year now will be the 100th anniversary of the Pendleton Roundup, and you're all invited. I do have a big backyard. And
we can camp.
Generally, we turn the water off on it at night. So
if they remember.
You were there at the first one, too, as I recall.
I've been accused of that, and also I've been accused of being a busboy at the Last Supper. So
now we'll move all the way over to the right. A new member.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Chris Garrett from Lake Oswego, Southwest Portland, District 38. Glad to be here. No other life changes to report.
Bill Garrard, Klamath County. Actually, Southern Klamath County, which is currently smoke-ridden thanks to Douglas County's incapability of putting out a simple fire. But we're having great difficulties. We all thought we were going to die, and then DEQ, which had been telling us we were going to die if we went outside, suddenly discovered that their equipment was malfunctioning and that all the numbers we were getting was wrong. So I'm ready for a DEQ bill of some kind. But it's nice to be back on rules and with the good chair.
Good to have you. Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mary Nolan, representing Southwest Portland. In my fifth term in the legislature, first term on rules, though. Glad to be here. Representative Reed, the life change in my family is that my daughter started high school this year, and I have become the dumbest woman in the world. So I think I've got about 5 or 6 more years before I start to learn a few things, and she'll let me know when that point arrives. You have that much to look forward to.
Thank you.
I think you could pretty well count on about the time she turned 15, we all became a little less intelligent.
Yeah, and you have longer to wait than you think.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I'm State Representative Vicki Berger. I'm happy to welcome all of you and all of you to my district, District 20, Salem area. Just sorry about the weather when you all came to town, but maybe it'll put out a few of those fires, so be it. And congratulations, Representative Reed. I love the name. Are there golfers in the family? Is that?
It's a little heritage that direction. But.
Well, I love the name, and I'm sure she's adorable.
Thanks.
And And I'm Representative Arnie Roblin, House District 9. I've enjoyed being the chair and with this great committee and the new additions. I look forward to us working in the interim and getting some things done. My life-changing event was my youngest got her final terminal degree in college. I have one daughter who's older who could go back for more, but all the rest of them have either got doctorates or terminal degrees in their program, so they're done, which is really kind of a fun thing to watch. And so you have that to look forward to, and it takes a lot longer than you might otherwise have thought at different times when they decide, oh, that would be good to go do, and it just keeps going on for a long time. But it was exciting for that and for our family, so that's been fun, too. With that, I'll let our two staff introduce themselves as well. We'll go over here to her.
I'm Sue Hampton with Committee
Services. Sue, it's great to have you here. It's really wonderful.
And I'm Beth Petrino. Very happy to be here. I've been staffing committees for a while. Last session, I staffed House Environment and Water, and I'm happy to be doing something different this time.
And it was really great when I was chair of the Agricultural and Natural Resources Committee. Beth was the chair. I was the administrator at that time for that committee as well. So it's been nice to have her come back and have someone to work with. So look forward to that. So with that, I would entertain a motion from my vice chair.
Mr. Chair, I move we adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 29th, 2009.
And hopefully have those on the next page. People look at them. They're the same ones that all the committees are using. And Representative Berger moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated September 29th, 2009. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to the rules? Seeing no objection, so ordered. Thank you very much. And with that, we have a number of informational meetings. And I guess the other thing that I want to encourage, and people in this committee have been very good about that, if there are issues that come up or there are bills or things that you would like to be considered for topics on our agenda, please get a hold of Beth, let her know, we'll work that out. And also, if you have any issues that you would like to have considered as committee bills, please let us know. We'll look at those and make some decisions as time goes on. But I just, the committee's been very good, has worked well together, and just let Beth know as time goes on, and we'll work towards that. So with that, we'll have our first informational meeting. And do you want to introduce our people, Beth?
I could do that.
Okay.
The first item on the agenda today is an overview of the 2010 census, and Charles Reinerson from Portland State has agreed to come and talk to the committee about that process.
Yep, and come on up. And my feeling is that we're getting ready with the census coming and with redistricting and all those other issues and rules. It may not be the committee that does all that, but I think we should start having a good understanding of what's going on as we get into this next session. So to me, it's one of those things that it may be something as we get on in the interim, we want to revisit again before the session starts. But I thought it was good to get people's heads around the ideas of what we're doing. And I really appreciate you coming and being here. So if you'll introduce yourselves.
Okay. Well, thank you, Chair Roblin and committee members. I'm glad that you invited me here because I always want people to know as much as they can about the census. And, in fact, as you say, if you need me to come back and speak to your colleagues or other committees, I'd be glad to do that as well sometime between now and the census. I'm from Portland State University Population Research Center, which is part of the College of Urban and Public Affairs, and we have had a close relationship with the Census Bureau for many decades. We've been what's known as the State Data Center lead agency since 1980, so that in every state, the Census Bureau has a network of agencies that receive the Census Bureau's data and warehouse it, maintain a library, help people access it, help people understand it. And that's my role as the coordinator of the State Data Center. So while we don't actually work that closely on the 2010 census, we do educate as much as possible, and we do assist the Census Bureau with minor tasks like, reminding jurisdictions to participate in the many programs that the Census Bureau has. So we have not only our office, but a whole network of affiliates in the state, and I hope you all got the folder.
Could you make sure you put your pronounce your whole name for the tape? So
oh, yes, Charles Reinerson. Thank you. In this folder, the Census Bureau, because of our relationship with them, they were kind enough to send materials that I requested specifically for this meeting. And they have a regional office in Seattle that helps us out with that. But our on the left-hand side of the folder, I've listed our affiliate network. So we have offices all over the state that work together with us in helping people access census data. And I thought it might be helpful if you had a list of those. And that's also found on our website, which is www.pdx.edu/PRC, Population Research Center. The other material on the right-hand side of the folder is all Census Bureau material, and I experimented with making a PowerPoint show of it, but if I had done that, you wouldn't be able to read any of it, and then we would have had to have the lights out, so you wouldn't have been able to read the handouts either. So I won't be offended if you're looking down and reading the material while I go over it with you. The top page there, the very colorful sheet that says Census 2010, has a nice little overview of some of the major things that have to happen. And the first yellow bubble, establish where to count, that has occurred already. Last spring, the Census Bureau sent workers out all over neighborhoods, all over America, making sure that they had all the addresses, that they updating their address lists. And they actually walked door to door. They came to my house and handed us a card, and they used GPSs to record the location. So they're updating the records, and there's another review part to that that our office is helping the Census Bureau with, and that is we're sending the Census Bureau detailed data such as tax parcel data from assessor's offices as a review. We're now in a period of count review, as it's called. So do they have all the housing units? That's tremendously important, and we want to make sure that we're helping them with that, and that and local jurisdictions are going to help with that too. Right now they're printing the census questionnaires. They just started last week, I think, and that's a lot of paper because they're going to mail them all in March to all the addresses that they gathered. They, of course, not all of them come back by mail. That's the first priority. They're supposed to be mailed back. When people don't respond, Census Bureau has to send workers to follow up in person. You know, maybe the place is vacant. They have to establish that. Or maybe people didn't respond and they're living there, so they have to count people who didn't mail in their survey. There is another review process that goes on involving group quarters addresses. You know, another tremendously important part of this is there's two places that people can live. They can live in housing units or in group quarters, such as jails, dormitories, nursing homes. So that count occurs as well, and there's a count review process for that that goes on after the census. But the big dates for redistricting purposes, well, the big date for reapportionment purposes is down there on the bottom next to that picture of the White House. Apportionment counts delivered to the president by December 31st, 2010. And so on that date, that's the first piece of information that comes from the census, and that will be the total population of each state, which people can start doing the math and figuring out how many U.S. congressional seats will be in each state. And that will be something we'll all be eagerly awaiting in Oregon. By April 1st, 2011, they will produce the population counts at the block level for redistricting purposes. By that time, they will have already sent geographic data to states, to the legislative majority and minority parties, and designated persons in each state's government. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later. The next thing in this folder is just a handout that says what elected officials need to know about the 2010 census. I don't really have anything to highlight from it, but given the title of the brochure, I figured I better include it because you are elected officials, so you can review that at your leisure. And the third thing in the folder is a black and white copy of the Federal Register notice from 2004 that laid out the redistricting data program. And you can see this taking the 2010 census actually starts as soon as the 2000 census is done. They reviewed what had occurred from the 2000 census and proposed how the redistricting data was going to work for the 2010 census. Oregon participated in phase one and phase two of this process, and there may be other people here who can talk more about that later. One thing I discovered is that under phase one, it says the legislative leadership of each state is to establish a Census 2010 redistricting data program liaison. So I figured I better find out who that is. And I found out it's Rick Berkobian here in the manager of committee services. So I've met him as of today, and we may be working more closely together on other census-related issues. Again, phases, the future phases, phase three talks about the delivery of the data that I mentioned before. And it is available to the public on April 1st, 2011 also. So although it's delivered formally to designated representatives of state government, it's also going to be available to everybody, at least at the block level. They may not have nowadays a lot of people have the GIS software that they need to do to manipulate the data. So there may be a lot of people who are interested in what the legislature's doing. The folder, well, if the next thing in the folder is a brochure talking about the many geographic programs of the Census Bureau, and these are a lot of acronyms, but they're very important. For example, the Boundary and Annexation Survey, as you can imagine, it's going to be important to every city and county that the Census Bureau has the correct boundaries for their jurisdiction. So the Census Bureau works with every jurisdiction annually, not just for the census, but to keep those boundaries current. And then the local update of census address program, something we've been a little bit involved in, again, making sure that the addresses are correct. That participant statistical areas program, another thing that's underway, boundaries. The local, mostly the councils of governments around the state recommend changes to census boundaries, such as census tracts. When the population of a census tract grows too much, it has to be split. So there's many agencies around the state involved in all of these geographic programs. And as soon as I'm done, I'll hope to entertain any questions. But just a couple more things that I gave you. The rest of the last items in the folder are specific to Oregon, and the Seattle office of the Census Bureau sent us this list, timeline of the major 2010 census operations. And the important thing I wanted to point out on this is in red up near the top, there were two local census offices that were opened in Oregon last Well, they've been open for several months in Eugene and Portland. In fact, they had kickoff events in both places this August. They participated in the address review that I described. On this week, October 1st, there are going to be three more local offices opening in Beaverton, Bend, and Salem. And I wish I could have brought the contact information with me for those and put them in the folders, but if you need to follow up, I can send it through Beth. I asked my contact at Census Bureau. She actually didn't have the phone numbers yet for the three opening up, so I'll try to scrape all that together. The map shows what portions of the state are covered by each of those local census offices. So, for example, the Eugene office covers everything from Lane County south on the west side of the mountains to the California border. Bend office, everything east of the mountains. You can see the pastel colors on that map. And another little, maybe a little more obscure thing here is this last map showing the hard-to-count score. And this, what this is just an example of something that the Census Bureau is doing to try to get a complete count. They have measured things like linguistic isolation and rural population, certain factors that they've discovered from previous censuses that make it harder to count, and in particular harder for people to send in the mail back their questionnaire. So these scores are highly correlated with the mail response rate, and in the lower scores are places that are easier to count in general, and the higher scores are places to harder to count. So they're actually putting additional resources into partnerships with local agencies and trying to get, you know, improve the count in some of these hard to count areas. Other things that are going on around the state are something called complete count committees. The Census Bureau encourages jurisdictions, state itself, all kinds of places to form committees. And the statewide committee, the Complete Count Committee, is headed by Secretary of State Kate Brown's office. And there are complete count committees all over the state in local areas. If you want to find out about your area, I think you could find that from the Seattle Regional Office. Census itself is going to be short this time. That's the best thing I can say about it, is there will be no long form in the 2010 census. There are only going to be 10 questions about each person in the census. And a whole other topic that you might want to consider on some other date is the fact that because there's no long form, there's a new survey called the American Community Survey that will collect, that is an ongoing survey already being done to collect the type of socioeconomic data that traditionally came from the long form. So when the results of 2010 come out, it's not going to include income, poverty, education, all those things that we're used to getting from the census every 10 years. We'll have to go to the American Community Survey to get that. So
must be a cell phone.
That's most of what I wanted
to
cover.
That's a cell phone. It's not you. That's just a cell phone.
Oh, good.
That's on.
Okay, not mine. I turned mine off. Okay, and so that's glad that the Census Bureau was able to send this material, and I hope it's useful to you. And my card is also in this folder. And if there are any questions, I'd be glad to entertain them.
Representative, would you like to ask a question?
I would, Mr. Chair.
That shocks me.
I know. I know. I just have to keep up my reputation. Will you or how do you, will you be differentiating between illegal immigrants and those regular residences of Oregon? Is there a way that you'll be able to tell the difference?
No. Well, the Census Bureau, and again, it's not our office conducting it, so we just have basically the same data that everybody else has, and it's published by the Census Bureau, and they don't ask about, they do ask whether people, no, because they're not doing a long form, they're not even asking if people are citizens. That's in the American Community Survey. So the questions are very simple. Name, age, sex, ethnicity, race, household relationship, and they don't know whether people are legally in this country or not. They just want to count everybody who's living in the U.S. on April 1st.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Charles, I think this information shows over 1.4 million temporary workers. How many in Oregon?
It's a good question, but we're slightly over 1% of the population, so I would hope that it's over 14,000. I was doing some of the math on that, too, because I used to supervise censuses, and we could count more people than that with our resources. But, of course, that's in urban areas, and I think this includes people processing the data and lots of other related jobs. But there will be lots of people hired, and that's something that in this current economy, you know, shouldn't be as difficult as it was in early 2000 when we hadn't yet entered that recession. It was hard to find people to work, and now the Census Bureau is actually having more people apply than they need.
Follow up, please.
So I didn't really see anything other than the number of people that are going to be hired, but is there something in this material that I missed that might direct people to those opportunities?
Well, in the folder, actually, there's on the left-hand side of the folder.
Okay, on the jobs
there's
piece.
There's the website and phone number for Census Jobs.
All right.
And that directs it to, I believe, the Seattle office. But once the local offices are opening, I believe they'll be hiring locally, too. It's standardized. Everybody takes the same test nationwide, but the hiring may go on at the, I think a lot of it does go on at the local level.
So I'll just do a follow-up on that one. So starting October 1st, just coming up, the other three, there'll be five offices mm-hmm. in place. And besides this number, they could stop by those offices if they're interested in a job.
That's correct.
Okay. Other questions? Do we know how many more residents in Oregon we need for that other congressional district, and what, you know, they've been kind of keeping track of that, and they keep putting Oregon on that waiver list about whether it will gain one or not.
Mm-hmm.
Any ideas right now from the stuff that you've been doing?
Well, it's going to be close, let's put it that way. And the big question is, are we growing faster than the nation these last 2 years of the decade like we did the first several years of the decade? Maybe not, because of the fact our unemployment rate is higher than elsewhere, and that usually slows down net migration. I think the answer is, and this is what other people have calculated, if we had continued to grow from 2008 to 2010, at the rate that we grew from 2000 to 2008, then yes, you know, we would just barely make it to get that sixth seat. But we don't know if that's still happening, and you know, our growth likely has slowed down a little bit, so it's going to be close.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just recalling a revenue forecast meeting we had a couple of months ago, and we were asking the state economist about our unemployment rate. And one of the things that he indicated was that our current unemployment rate may be inflated by the number of people who are moving into Oregon because they've always wanted to live here. They've lost their jobs in other places, and they're coming in.
Mm-hmm.
If that indeed is the case, do you still believe that the growth is declining?
Yeah, and I have heard that, and it does make a lot of sense. I've heard what Tom Pitowski, the state economist, has said about that, and it does make sense. I think it is happening. They've also talked about unemployment rate being high because more existing residents entering the labor force, you know, maybe people who had retired and thought they wouldn't need to work and they're going back to work, or spouses whose spouse has been laid off entering the labor force. There's some of that going on. I don't doubt that there are still people moving here without jobs because they want to live here, but probably not at the rate that they were a few years ago when our unemployment rate was lower than the nation.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the material, I think it indicates that the census has a lot to do with funding from the federal government to local to states. Obviously, it has to do with congressional seats and Senate or congressional seats, obviously. But I'm troubled by the fact that it might be argued that growth in population would have more to do with those issues just discussed than legal residence. So could it be argued, I suppose, that states would not want to enforce and or know who was legal or who wasn't if the incentive is more people means more congressional seats, more people means more federal funding?
But that's an interesting question. I mean, they may, on that day, April 1st, 2010, yes, they may want as many people living there as possible. The rest of the decade, you know, then that's another issue. But yeah, there is an incentive to have the biggest population possible on that date when the census is taken. So, you know, the politics of that are complex.
Just as a follow-up?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a statistical reason that we don't say whether or not people are legal? I mean, that we're not counting legal residents versus non-legal residents? I mean, if funding is based on that, if representation is based on it, why doesn't that apply in the count? Do you have any?
Well, that debate does go on at the national level, and people debate about the interpretation of the Constitution and what does it mean that a complete count is taken. You know, the language, I don't have the language in front of me, but it on one side of the debate, you know, people will say that you know, the Constitution says we're supposed to count everybody living here. On the other side, you know, there were, when that was written and the way it's written, you know, may not have been the intention. So that debate goes on, and it's, you know, at this point, they do want to count everybody who's living here. So if that were, you know, that would require a congressional, I think, at the national level, you know, require a change in order to do something differently.
Do they have an expectation now that we're doing a short form that they will get more returns sooner than
That's the hope, because used to be one out of every six households got the long form, and people were bothered by some of the, it was a very long form, and questions about income and education and details about your housing unit. So the hope is that there'll be better participation with only a short form.
And is there follow-up by these 14,000 employees with every household, even if they've turned the form in, just to make sure the people are actually there? Is that the goal?
That's a good question. When we've conducted our own census, we've done random spot checks. I don't have the answer to that, how the Census Bureau does quality control, but I can find out, or the Census Bureau officials might be able to let you know in local offices.
And I know that when they had the opening in Lane County, since I, part of my district is Lane, they sent us a deal inviting us to come over to Eugene to see that. I assume that's probably happening here in Salem.
I have gotten no such invitation.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
You're not wanted.
I guess not.
Yeah, and it may, actually, those offices, those Portland and Eugene offices, were open for several months before they had their grand opening.
Oh, okay.
The other offices won't have that ability since the census is happening 6 months after their opening. But I would guess that that they're going to open. They probably will have some kind of event, but not immediately when they're opening. They'll have their grand opening sometime well after they're settled in.
Okay.
Didn't invite you right away.
No, he was saying they actually happened almost in 2000. When did they first start these offices? It was August before I got an invitation. So
they opened in August. That's what he said.
Well, they were open before.
Yeah, they had their grand opening events in August, but they were open in the spring because they were out there counting people. They did their address canvassing, and then they had their fall 2008. Eugene and Portland offices opened. So they were open.
It was a year later.
Almost a year before they had their grand opening.
Before they invited me.
And they're a little hard to find. That's why I should have brought their addresses. There's nowhere on the Census Bureau's website that says where their local offices are. But it should be public information. People call me because if you Google Oregon Census, Oregon Census State Data Center at Portland State University comes up. That's my most important reason for knowing where those offices are.
Representative Jensen.
Yeah, the line of questioning a couple here led me to this question. Are there any legal or constitutional implications for counting or not counting people where they are actually residing in?
Well, they want to count everybody in the place that they're residing. So,
okay, they like to count them in the place where they're residing.
Mm-hmm.
But are there any implications, you know, to that? Are there any strings attached, you know, to that?
No, except for the debate that I mentioned before, that, you know, there are many people who don't think that's the way it should be conducted, and that debate has been going on nationally.
Well, Mr. Chair, clarify. Last session, we passed what I would call a gerrymandering bill where prisoners would no longer be counted where they reside, but instead would be counted in the area of residence at the time of incarceration.
Right.
And I'm curious how this might or might not, if this might or might not have any implications.
It might. You know, I'm not sure. Well, probably the federal government won't. There will have to be some, if that's the way the Oregon law is written, there will have to be some juggling going on, because I don't think the federal government is going to follow those rules. Although the census is self-reported, so if somebody, that's one of the great dangers and strengths and weaknesses, I guess, of the census. People do report things that don't fit in perfectly with the Census Bureau's rules about the way things are supposed to be done. For example, your housing unit. You know, you say that you live in, you say you rent your home. You know, you fill that out on the form. There's, if somebody doesn't understand what type of complicated arrangement that they have, or their family member fills out the form, you know, they could fill it out wrong. Same thing with residents. A lot of people want to count, for example, college students. People want to count their college students at their homes when in fact the Census Bureau would rather count their college students at the college if they live there most of the time. So there is, residency is a touchy issue, and it's always complex. And I do realize that the Oregon passed this law, and not sure how it's all going to play out.
Did we pass it?
Or, well, did they pass it, or is it still?
It's passed.
Senate passed it, too?
I don't know. We passed it. I don't know.
I'll check on that one.
I don't recall this discussion at all being considered at
the time
we were.
I agree. It was not.
Yeah. And it's just that curiosity.
Well, thank you, yeah. Representative Jensen, for bringing that up. It's an important question.
So any further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. And thank you for the information. I will look it over some more, especially my little obligation as an elected official.
Okay. Thank you.
So with that, we're going to move on to 2011 redistricting. And we have legislative counsel here. So if you want to come up and introduce yourself.
Tara Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Gina Zedlick. I'm deputy legislative counsel. And I've been asked to talk to you today about redistricting, to get your feet wet, so to speak. So I've taken it as at least from the legal perspective, it's a pretty big topic. So I'm not sure exactly how much detail you're interested in today, but I hopefully have achieved enough of a balance between giving you an overview and identifying where the complicated issues are. And if, you know, in the future, we'll be going through this, so I would be happy to, you know, if you need things in writing or topics that you're more curious about, I would be happy to elaborate on at a later date. And I think, just while I'm thinking about it, I don't think that prison, I think that what Representative Jensen, the question you asked, that bill did not pass. And I think that was getting to the population of prisons. And so anyway, just wanted to make that clear. So in terms of redistricting, kind of like all things, you've got kind of huge and distinct bodies of law that are governing it. So at the federal level, you have the Equal Protection Clause, which applies. So it's the one person, one vote, which is the adage you've probably heard. That's what they're talking about. There's Article 1, Section 2 of the U.S. Constitution that only applies to congressional redistricting, though, and not state. There's Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. Section 5 mainly applies to southern states, so we don't have to worry about that here in Oregon. And then you have Section 2 of the Federal Voting Rights Act, which does apply nationally. And basically what Section 2, the purpose of that is to effectuate the 15th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution to guarantee that no citizen's right to vote be abridged on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. So basically, Section 2 prohibits any procedure that impairs the ability of a racial minority to elect its candidates of choice on an equal basis as other voters. And then you have decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court, and then you have, and that's all the federal law you have to worry about. And then you have state law. The main state law is Section 6, Article 4 of the Oregon Constitution. We have one statute, ORS 188.010, which sets forth some requirements. And then finally, you have decisions of the Oregon Supreme Court. So you have a lot to take into account. You can feel free to, you know, let me know if there's a certain direction that you would like to go in. But what I thought I would do is start with the Oregon requirements, the timeline of how things should go, and then highlight a few of the major areas that can be complicated and contentious, and give you a sense of what kinds of things to be thinking about to stay within, to not violate any one of the, you know, eight types of law I've just mentioned. So at a basically, Section 2 of Article 4 of our Constitution requires there be, you know, no more than 30 senators and 60 representatives, and that Section 6 requires that the number of senators and representatives be fixed by law, apportioned among districts according to population, and each Senate district must consist of two representative districts. And that's what's set out in the Oregon Constitution, so it's not a lot. That's the main requirement set out in Article 4. So the timeline, I think most of you know this, but you have the year following the census, so that's 2011. You have until July 1st to pass a, to enact a redistricting plan. And if you do that, then any elector has, there's a certain point where they can go to the Oregon Supreme Court and file a petition criticizing any part of that. If the court finds the petition doesn't have any merit, the legislature's plan becomes effective. If the court finds there is merit to the petition, the court will review that and direct the Secretary of State to make changes to the plan as directed with specificity by the court. And then once the Secretary of State makes those changes, then the plan goes back to the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court can look at it and then make further changes. As far as I know, every time the Supreme Court sent it back to the Secretary and the Secretary's made changes, the court hasn't made any further changes on their own. If the legislature fails to enact a plan by July 1st, then the task falls to the Secretary of State. And it's kind of substantially the same process. There's a period where the Secretary of State comes up with a plan, there's a public comment period, and then the voters have the same ability to go to the Supreme Court and say, and petition the court to review the plan. And this always happens. Whatever plan is passed by whomever, it is the subject of litigation, and it has been without fail. The only thing that I should highlight, and this just changed, as you know, was HJR 31 was referred by the 2007 Legislative Assembly to the people, and the people approved it in 2008. And it adjusted the operative dates of a plan adopted by the Secretary of State or by the Legislative Assembly. It basically to address, try and minimize the problem of suddenly redistricting and drawing all these new lines and having representatives and senators assigned to, you know, totally different districts. So what this does is it makes whatever plan become operative on the second Monday in January of the next odd-numbered year after the deadline for making the reapportionment. In English, this is, so if July 1, 2011 is your deadline, the second Monday in January of 2013, it will become operative. So there's a couple year lag time there. The only exception to this is that for purposes of running for re-election, January 1 of 2012 will be the operative date. So this should take care of almost all of those times. There are conceivably some senators that will have to be reassigned to new districts. But again, I think that change largely minimized what used to be a really big problem. So to get into, that's the basic timeline structure, how things go. Now I'll get into actually what the redistricting process. And I should note that whether the Secretary of State does this or whether the Legislative Assembly does this, you're largely subject to the same rules, and that you have the same authority. So all of this applies to both equally. ORS 188.010 sets forth that each district, as nearly as practicable, be contiguous, of equal population, use existing geographic or political boundaries, not divide communities of common interest, and be connected by transportation links. It also prohibits drawing districts for the purpose of favoring any political party, incumbent legislator, or other person, or for the purpose of diluting the voting strength of any language or ethnic minority group. And when a court, every time the Oregon court looks at a plan, it reviews a plan. It reviews it according to all of those principles. It reviews it according to U.S. constitutional issues. I mean, it uses, it can review the entire gamut there. I also might, in discussing this, we'll be referring to traditional districting principles, and this is something they talk about, that the U.S. Supreme Court talks about, and their compactness, contiguity, consideration for existing political subdivisions, and consideration for communities of interest. So one thing to note about all these different types of law is that they're slightly different but largely parallel. So you have, you know, a lot of the things will sound a little bit different, but basically they're the same principles that are guiding a lot of these laws. So the main the things that I think were the most important, I've the next part of what I'll talk about is equal population, what that really means, partisan gerrymandering, discrimination, and racial gerrymandering. So I'll begin with equal population. So you're tasked with to draw districts that are nearly as nearly equal as practical in population. And obviously, there are some deviations, as you can probably tell. But near equality is expected. And any deviation will really be suspect by a court and will require the Legislative Assembly or the Secretary of State to justify why something has deviated. And there are reasons. There are legitimate state interests for not having something be, you know, 100 people here and 100 people in the next one, too. And I guess that underlies one of the messages today that I think is probably the most important thing for you to take away, is just to be able to articulate why the lines are drawn the way they are, and to be able to articulate good faith state interests and why and how the lines that are drawn are consistent with state law and what goals you're trying to achieve with those.
And we're using the most recent federal census?
Yes. You'll be using the 2010.
Numbers. Mm-hmm. That's the actual numbers we use to get that equalness.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So when they do the census and they put these people in all these places, that's where we start.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, the Oregon Constitution says according to population.
Okay.
So it doesn't say according to the census exactly. And actually, there was a case right after that challenged the 2001 redistricting plan that the Secretary of State adopted. And there was a, many of you may remember this, but there was, what happened there was that the U.S. Census erroneously put a prison, I think the prison was in Sheridan, and it said it was in a different district. So there was a there's 2,000, about 2,000 people that were off in that. And this came to the Secretary of State's attention, but the Secretary of State felt confined by using the actual census numbers, even though they knew there was a big error. And the court actually said that you can use other, in that case, the Secretary of State should have gone outside of the census numbers and used other information. So that's the first time the court said that, and that was in 2001, and so, you know, but yeah, I think it is your start. I mean, it's your starting line, and that's why it's the reason for doing it in 2010 or 11. So when with equal population, and in each of these, you have congressional versus legislative districts. So there's always slightly different things that apply. So for congressional district, equal population means near strict equality. That's because of Article 1, Section 2 of the U.S. Constitution, which only applies to congressional redistricting. So that's really strict. And so that's probably with an overall range of about 1%. So when we're talking about this, you know, if you have 100, if 100 is your, you know, 100 people are supposed to be in each district if you divide the population of the state, and then you have a district with 102, and then you have another district with 98, for purposes of what we're talking about, the overall range there would be 4%. So when we're talking congressional districts, we're talking very, very close, very little deviation.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Gelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you help me understand? You said one of the principles is not breaking apart communities of interest. How do we then end up in plans? I know the community that I represent, our city, which isn't a particularly large city, is broken up and has three different legislators that represents part of it. Is that just a consequence of having to prioritize the roughly equal versus breaking apart communities of interest?
Yeah, I imagine it is. I mean, basically, you know, you have, basically doing this is one big balancing test where you have all these things that you're supposed to do and not do, and you can justify not doing one thing because you're trying to do something else or something like that. And so maybe that's what happened there. There's no kind of, you know, there's not just one thing that's the most important thing. They're all in there. So I don't know. That might be, and I will discuss a little bit more about what communities of interest are and what they might mean in a minute.
Thank you.
So let's see. So congressional districts, very little, pretty strict equality. And again, any deviation should be documented. Why is what's the need for the deviation? And also to note, under the U.S. Jurisprudence, incumbents might be a legitimate state interest. However, here, Oregon, ORS 188.010, says that that's not one of our interests. You cannot, you know, protection of incumbents is not a legitimate state interest. So you have, not only do you have these things that kind of the federal and state agree upon are important, but you also have some things that directly contradict each other, too, to manage in all of this. Anyway, so congressional near strict equality, Oregon and state legislative districts in general have more leeway, at least under like the federal courts. You know, the U.S. Supreme Court would allow up to a 10% deviation. And that's not to say that if something's under 10% deviation, it's automatically okay. But they haven't, you know, if it's over 10%, there it's going to be highly, highly suspect. And in fact, in Oregon, I think in the 1991 census, the Secretary of State adopted a rule that was plus or minus 1%. So they went narrower than is actually required at the federal level. And the Oregon Supreme Court said that's okay, that Oregon can be more narrow if they want to be, and that was a valid standard in 1991. So that's kind of the numbers part. Partisan gerrymandering is the next topic. And basically, a congressional or state legislative redistricting plan should not unconstitutionally discriminate against a partisan minority or be drawn for the purpose of favoring any party, political party. So the Equal Protection Clause, and this is one of these areas where we have competing kind of, they seem competing. So the Equal Protection Clause basically says that you can't deny a political party fair representation, a minority political party fair representation. But these claims are very hard to prove. You have to prove that not only is there a discriminatory effect, but there was discriminatory intent. So you'd have to prove, based on things said on the record and other evidence, that the Legislative Assembly or Secretary of State intended to discriminate against this minority party. ORS 188.010, on the other hand, kind of phrases that a little bit different. It says you can't favor any political party. So at the same time you're trying not to discriminate against one, you're also trying not to favor. So you've got those kind of competing interests, and obviously you can do one, you can do both at the same time. So again, I mean, this highlights the importance of the record. Saying what you're doing and why you're doing it is very important, and a court will look at that if these things are challenged in court. So for partisan gerrymandering things, a couple ways to avoid issues is to, you know, have both major political parties participate in the drawing of these lines, and be able to show that any resulting plan is not overtly designed to discriminate against or favor or a particular party or legislator, and to draw lines based on the traditional redistricting principles that I'd mentioned earlier, you know, contiguousness, compactness, those types of things. minority discrimination is just kind of my way of talking about the next, my next kind of area. Because a redistricting plan may be invalidated if it discriminates against a racial, ethnic, or language minority group, or if it is the result of the racial gerrymandering, which is the deliberate and arbitrary distortion of district boundaries for racial purposes. So discrimination issues are generally litigated under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, whereas racial gerrymandering is under the Equal Protection Clause. And then you've got, again, Oregon statute on top of all of this. So anyway, this doesn't all have to sink in today, but it's just, you know, it's this area that's very, I mean, I would say it's very gray. And Representative Gelser has already, you know, highlighted one part of that. So there's a couple ways that minorities have been discriminated against, and that's referred to as dilution. You can either dilute their vote by packing making a minority group the majority into one district. So by packing, or you can do it by fracturing, by separating out a minority group into so many areas that their vote doesn't matter in the same way it would if they were in one place. So this is probably one of the areas where there's the most Supreme Court jurisprudence on this. So you've got like hundreds and hundreds of pages of what these things mean. So this is in a very like bird's eye view nutshell. So sometimes under Section 2, the court will require the legislative assembly to create a special district that's often referred to as a minority-majority district. And this happens if, in an ideal district, the minority group could elect the minority's candidates of choice, if the minority group population has been politically cohesive, and if block voting by the majority has usually defeated the candidate preferred by the minority. So if all those things are true, then you may be required to draw this special district in which you create a majority of the minority, if that makes any sense. And not necessarily, of course. It's only if, you know, then the court, even if all those things are true, a court will look and say, well, do the totality of the circumstances of the state really require us to do this? And those types of things, they will look at history of official discrimination, they will look at the extent to which the state is or political subdivision is racially polarized. They will look at whether campaigns have been characterized by racial appeals. I mean, all sorts of things. But one of the main things they look at is what they call proportionality. And that basically says that if a minority group makes up a voting majority in a number of districts that is substantially proportional to its share of the state population, then it's very unlikely that one of these special districts will have to be created. So that just, I hope that makes some sense. But then this touches on all the issue that Representative Gelser already brought up. You know, how do you identify when is a minority group sufficiently large to constitute a majority? So how do you count a majority? Is that a simple majority? Is it an effective majority? Who do you count? Do you count people of voting age? Do you count people who are registered to vote? Do you count only citizens? And so, I mean, it raises all those issues. How do you even determine whether, whether there is political cohesiveness? What do you look to? What kinds of facts do you look to determine whether a group is cohesive enough, or whether they vote, or whether their vote is likely, you know, to be diluted? And I mean, the list goes on. And so that's where you can get into, I mean, there's a lot, it's complicated, and there's a lot of issues that are legal, but they're also factual as well. Then finally, there's racial gerrymandering, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. And that is, you know, when you draw the lines just to discriminate against a certain racial group. And if this happens, a court will basically, I mean, almost always this will get struck down, because the court will look at this under strict scrutiny. It says that this is a violation of the Equal Protection Clause. The state would have to show a very compelling reason why it drew lines a certain way. And not only that, but that show that there was not really another way to do it, so that it was narrowly tailored to that interest. And these can be very long and complicated too, just like the last area I highlighted, not only, mostly because you have to consider race. And it's assumed that you will consider race when doing this, but they're trying to draw lines between considering race and being aware of something like that versus intentionally isolating a group of people. And again, this is, you know, all goes into the balancing test and the kinds of interests you say on the record and your reasons for drawing those things. And of course, in this instance, you know, a court would look to see if, you know, there's like some sort of snake-like district drawn, you know, so bizarre boundaries would be one of the indicators that this might be happening. Statements by legislators would be another. And also, I think this, and I, you know, this kind of with time, I think the your software is getting very advanced, and so I don't know where this type of sociological information will come from, but I'm sure that it will arrive from somewhere. And so a court would also look at what kind of information you did know about in this type of case. And similarly, our statute says that you can't draw boundaries for the purpose of diluting the voting strength of any language or ethnic minority group. So I think that would fall, you know, a court has never looked at this specific statute before, that subsection of the statute, so I can't really speak to exactly what the Oregon court would say about it, but I think it's probably safe to look at the Section 2 jurisprudence articulated by the U.S. Supreme Court to figure out kind of where the Oregon court would go with looking at that. And then that is the other, I just have kind of a few, I'm kind of done with my major overview. There's a few other things you have to make sure that you do. I think I've covered that already. I think I looked through all the past Oregon Supreme Court cases and things that have changed over the years and case law. So this is stuff you wouldn't find in the statutes, but case law has determined that the U.S. Constitution takes precedence over the Oregon Constitution. So if you're battling with something the Oregon Constitution says that you have to do, you know, for existence, that there's a section in there about county lines that you're not supposed to, you know, divide up county lines. But if you're really trying to make sure that you're not doing, you know, this gerrymandering instead, that would win out. So U.S. Constitution principles win out over Oregon to the extent necessary. They've clarified that, I think I've said that the Secretary of State has substantially the same powers as the Legislative Assembly in enacting a plan, and that both are entitled to latitude in applying the criteria, and there's flexibility in application. So, and I think that is all I have, and I would be happy to answer questions.
It's not really a question, Mr. Chair, but and I'm kind of admitting to being one of the senior members in this building, but I was on the 2001 Rules and Redistricting Committee, and Carl Wilson of Grants Pass chaired that committee, and we went all over the state, and Representative Gelser has put her finger right on the number one question wherever we went, was the breaking up of community interest. And so I just kind of raised the flag for this committee, for those of us that are on it then and so forth. But that's really one of the criteria we really need to pay attention to as we look at redistricting, because that will be controversial.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dina, when was the last time in Oregon that the Legislative Assembly had the final plan and not the Secretary of State?
It was Representative Berger, committee members.
Long before you were born, I suspect.
Hey. It looks like 1981.
I don't know. I'm not going to put you on the spot on that. I would have said going back to the 60s.
There were 61 and 81, I think, that they successfully did it.
That the Legislative Assembly came up with a plan.
Well, and I should clarify, too, that in 2001, the Legislative Assembly did, but it was vetoed. They didn't override it.
Right. And then the Secretary of State
Then it fell to the Secretary of State.
Made the plan. I just wanted to bring that to the committee's attention because it's a lot of work, as Representative Girard will attest, and a lot of work that sometimes then goes by the wayside when that plan gets thrown away and a new plan from the Secretary of State's office. Where am I looking? suddenly, then the controversy goes on, and I guess this committee would do well. I'm glad, Mr. Chair, that you're bringing forward this discussion because I think this committee would do well to maybe start now to do some planning for all the what-ifs and see if maybe the legislature actually could do this next time because I think it's a better venue. It's a hard venue, but I think it's a more fair venue than throwing it back into the Secretary of State's office, a single office. Thank you.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gina, you mentioned when you started litigation that resulted from disagreements of various types. What's the most substantive outcome of litigation in Oregon? I mean, the result of that litigation, what's the biggest change that's come about because of all that litigation?
Well, you know, it's Representative Hanna, there's a lot of litigation every time it happens, but it's every 10 years, and so there's really not that much. And so when I went through to see what had happened, most of the time, there's always, I mean, I don't know, a lot of people filing petitions on a lot of different issues. And the majority of each case kind of starts with the Supreme Court saying, no, the Secretary of Legislative Assembly, they did that fine. There's no you haven't shown any proof that they've had this, you know, this intent to do this. And it kind of goes through that way. And so those last things that I just highlighted about the U.S. Constitution taking precedence, the Secretary of State having substantially the same powers as the Legislative Assembly, the court considering all applicable laws, the deviation, the latitude in applying, those are the things that have come out. Because there's only, they usually take, there would be a lot of cases, except they usually consolidate them into one and then go through and dismiss a lot of the things they don't find with merit.
Follow up?
Yes.
Thanks, Gina. And I mean, I'm asking the question because I think most of us as observers or participants have seen over time lots of litigation and very little change. And to the point of, I mean, to Representative Gelzer's comment, breaking up a community. I mean, one might question why there are 17 or 18 House districts that have a little sliver of Multnomah County. I mean, hard to prove somebody's intention in doing that. One might surmise intent, but hard to prove, hard to say you're doing it with ill intent. So interesting about the litigation. My second question is around the residency piece, and you're going to have to help me because I missed some of your timing, but you have a 2013 implementation. And after the last census, you had members who ended up representing districts that literally they didn't live within the district. I mean, kind of some oddities about that. These date issues purport to fix that, correct?
And they fix most of it.
Just follow up. So if you are one of the Senate districts, as an example, and you become the census or the redistricting puts you outside of your district, how do our rules for residency in the district, would this timeline allow someone who said, oh, I still want to represent my district, could they then move in time to get elected in their district, or does it allow for that? I see a head nodding in the back, maybe. No? Okay. I don't know if you can answer that or not. It's just...
Yeah. Or is that the Secretary of State?
No, maybe not.
If I understand your question correctly, so before what would happen is that the effective date of the plan would take place sometime in 2011
mm-hmm.
instead of 2013.
Right.
So yes, there are a few senators that may, because they will be in the middle of their term. I don't have this super solid in my head, but I think because they'll be in the middle of their term, they could be assigned for a period of 2 years to a district, another district.
That would be outside of their
right.
current boundary, their right. new boundary.
Right.
Okay.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you. So if during that 2 years, that individual senator is assigned to a place outside their current boundary for that two-year overlap, do you end up with individuals who then may have double representation because the senator lives in the old boundary, they're not in their district, they still live in another Senate district?
Sorry.
So say there's a senator from Jonestown and the redistricting has him now representing Smithtown and his two-year period lags over.
Mm-hmm.
So we let him continue representing the district, which now includes Smithtown, but
mm-hmm.
not Jonestown.
Mm-hmm.
So he's technically representing Smithtown, but his history and his residence is actually in Jonestown, which now is in another district and has another senator elected to represent those
right.
individuals. Do those people then have double representation while the
no.
people in Smithtown
no.
have none?
No. What happens is that, they might assign a senator to represent somewhere else for a period of 2 years, but anyone who would run for re-election, I mean, the Constitution requires that every place be equally, have, you know, their required number of senators and representatives. And so the assigning part comes, that's part of the Constitution. You can't have a redistricting plan that doesn't assign. If there is a new place without one, you have to move somebody over there. And then for purposes of re-election, that date swings earlier, so people wouldn't run to, if he wanted to run again, he would have to run for Jonestown instead of Smithtown.
Right, I understand that part.
I
feel like I'm missing, and I think a picture would help a little bit. But if the effective date, and you've got a Senate that's a four-year term, and that senator's district is impacted in the middle of that four-year term, so her re-election date doesn't come up before the effective date of the bill, and she still lives in the wrong place. Is she removed from office then before that time, and you have an election of a new senator?
I don't think so. I think I'm still.
my thinking is that they either have to move into the other district, or they will lose it. I mean, if I have a four-year
yeah.
term, and
you guys probably.
You know, I have this four-year term running. I just got elected for a four-year term. And then census takes place, and I'm outside of my new district, which is now over here, and I live right here on the edge. I get to finish out the interim.
Right, but then
I don't get to finish out my 4 years. I have to run
yeah.
or move into that district.
You have to
I don't
run.
Think so.
Or I think
I
you have to run.
So.
It's not what happened in 2000,
mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair.
Okay.
It is not what happened in 2001. We actually had this circumstance in 2001 at least once, and you may know better than I do. We certainly had representatives. With us, it's a two-year
right.
term, and so by the...
You get to fix that.
But for a period of time, representatives represented districts in which they did not reside.
Right.
And for at least one state senator, Senator Gordley, she represented for 2.5 years a district in which she did not reside. She did happen to move into that district and ran then for election to that new district, but it was in 2004. She had just been elected in 2000. We changed the lines. She was elected to a four-year term and served the full 4 years, but we did have to change something allowing that kind of thing for a period of time. But there's
Chair,
some precedent.
I think that gets
to
what the
up?
Question what the
yeah.
question was. So in Senator Gordley's circumstance, she was now representing a district in which she did not, or a geographical area in which she did not live.
Yes.
Theoretically, somebody else was representing the district in which she did live.
Yes.
Right.
Having been elected by the district in which she did live and continuing to live in the district in which she lived but did not represent, therefore, didn't the people in the district where she lived have double representation? They had the new person that they elected, and they had her, even though she was formally representing the other. She lived, they had two people living in their Senate district that were serving in the legislature at the same time.
There were two people living within a certain geographic boundary who both had votes in the Senate. But Senator Carter cast a vote on behalf of the 100,000 or so people living in that district, and Senator Gordley cast a vote representing the 100,000 so people living in a different geographic area.
Right.
Each group of 100,000 or so people had one vote representing them in the Senate.
And I understand that part. I think what I'm stuck on, though, could you make the argument that you had two senators living in the same district, even though one technically was casting votes for a different
community that they weren't living in.
And so the influence that was available to that particular district in which Senator Carter and Senator Gordley lived arguably had more voice in the legislature than others that might not have that circumstance.
We also have our Office of the Secretary of State here to answer the question. So, Mr. Pack, do you want to?
I get what you're saying.
Mr. Chair, members, if you can add any enlightenment to this.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Barry Pack, Deputy Secretary of State. I will try to illuminate what is, as Gina has said, a very confusing set of laws and rules. I think a good way to think about this is after redistricting, oftentimes a representative or a senator may find themselves assigned a new district number, and the representation of the people is attached to that number. So if you think about the 100,000 or so people who live within a geographic boundary that may be assigned a number, 20, they are represented by the person who is designated to represent that district number. Eventually, there will come a time when that legislator's residence must match the geographic boundary. But the changes that were made in,
2008
were an attempt to lengthen the period of time before that person had to actually move. So if you think about a four-year Senate term, by setting out an operative date 2 years, you take care of those circumstances where a person is midterm of a Senate, is assigned a new district number, therefore a new district. But it's not, they don't have to move until that operative date. So they can continue to serve for that longer period of time. Because what the Constitution and the statutes don't create is a circumstance where there are special elections being set up to accommodate these circumstances.
So, Barry, I think, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you just answered the question that I kind of started on the residency issue. Because of the change we made in the ruling, if you use the example that you talked about, Representative Nolan, that senator would have, in that case, would have had roughly a year and a half, could have been representing the new district number, had probably a year and a half to decide, do I want to move and physically now reside there and establish my residency of a year before election time came about. Before, in the previous system, he or she would have had only whatever that time period was left. You see what I'm saying? I mean, in that case, she would have had 6 months to decide, wow, I got to move, because if I want to get elected in the new district, I got to be in there sooner. So this just gives them the opportunity to make that decision over a little longer period of time.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Hannah, that's my understanding as well. The only difference is if they would normally have to stand for election in 2012, they would have to move within the residency requirement period, because it becomes operative for purposes of election.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I don't want us to lose the point that I think Representative Gelser is making, though. There are two perspectives on looking at this. There's the perspective of the legislator, sitting legislator, and I believe Representative Gelser's trying to point out that there is also the perspective of the electorate, the voters themselves, who did not
under this current statute have an opportunity to vote for or against or for someone in that position. And that's something we need to just lay out and acknowledge is there. And whether that provokes us to do something about it, that's up to debate. But it is an issue that we shouldn't ignore.
I agree with you to a point. The only thing is they may have had, I mean, a portion,
some of them may
a portion
have, yes.
of them. I mean, depending on
yes.
how the line was drawn.
Exactly.
You're not going to say none of them got to vote for that person.
Right, exactly.
It could have been half of them or, I mean.
Right.
Good point.
Yeah.
And I guess the reason that I wanted to start having this conversation was exactly the reason that Representative Berger brought up, and that I am personally believe that the best solutions come if the legislature does what they're supposed to do and works together to come up with those solutions. And we have all these conversations. They are exceedingly complex. There is no doubt about that. You know, when we had a little discussion last time in rules, you know, the county people came and said, please keep the precincts kind of in the same deals because there are places where, because of the congressional districts and other stuff, there are certain voters that get stuck out there, and by the time you look at each of the deals, you can tell exactly how they voted, because they are in three different jurisdictions, and you're looking at it and saying, whoa, that poor family is kind of stuck out there. And everybody acknowledged that did happen. And so, you know, with annexations that have happened and the ways things are going out, cities want to have districts that they can call the city district and not have to come up with a whole new kind of voting deal other than the precinct. So it is a very complex issue to try to get those things together. And I think the thing that we just brought up here, the more you can keep close to the boundaries that exist already, the better it is for most of those people because they're used to having those same people. So it is complex. And as we know, just knowing where those boundaries are is not always easy. We've had that problem in the past. So hopefully we can figure out, you know, when we do this, that everybody knows exactly what the boundaries are. And I agree that the technology now, the GPS stuff, all that other kind of stuff, should make some of that much easier. But it's still interesting how certain pieces of property get cut in half and others it goes around their property lines. And how do you make sure you get that in the right places for all that to happen? And I would love to see the legislature solve this problem and have one like 1981. It would be nice. Because we do know we have a process that solves it regardless of whether we do or not. And that's always caused its own litigation as well. Any other questions? Thank you very much. And thanks for taking it and putting it in that sense. For me, that was really helpful. Unlike Representative Garrard, I didn't get to sit through this in the past. and I'm sure that he's looking forward to trying to do it again. That's the other thing that happens in the legislature. By the time it comes up, the people who did it the last time oftentimes are not around for the next time. So they don't. They have to suffer all the same learning pains again, which is interesting. So thank you.
Thank you.
And with that, we'll move on to election law update. So we have our Mr. Peck and Mr. Trout.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, Barry Pack, Deputy Secretary of State. And let me just say that listening to this last discussion and having also been here in this building in 2001 and taking part in that deliberations, I'd like to take this moment to express my full confidence that the legislature will be able to pass the redistricting plan that the governor will sign. Please. We're here today. I'm here to introduce the new director of the Elections Division, and together we'll give a brief overview of some of the election law changes and the status update. We'll be as brief as you want to keep you on schedule, and happy to answer any questions. So I will be very brief. Steve Trout here to my right is on his 15th day as our director of elections, little trial by fire. He's been kept a little busy recently and will be busy for some time now. He comes to us from the state of California, where he has a long career in election law and election administration. He was senior elections counsel to the California Secretary of State. He then was the assistant registrar of voters for San Bernardino County. So he has both the state and local perspective on election administration and understands the importance of a very good, strong, cooperative working relationship between the state and our partners in the counties. After that, he went on as a consultant advising counties and other election jurisdictions, mostly in the West, on the application and administration of election law and election law changes. He's a great hire. We're very pleased to have him with you, and you'll be seeing a lot more of him in February and the years to come. Hopefully I'll still be here before you. I do enjoy my time before the Rules Committee, but you'll have a new expert to help you along as you consider election law issues. And with that, I would just turn it over to Mr. Trout.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Again, Steve Trout, Director of Elections. I'm excited to be here. And as Barry said, I've been doing elections exclusively for over 12 years now, and actually started as a legislative staffer in a recount situation, huddling over people's shoulders to monitor a really close vote, and been involved in election law and litigation and administration ever since. As you know, there's a lot of election legislation passed in the last session that we're working on as we speak. Representative Nolan was able to come over this morning and observe the processing of the petitions that we're doing down in the basement of the PSB. And I know an invitation has been extended to you all as well, and so we hope you come over and see that new process that came about from House Bill 2005. We're making good progress and are excited about the opportunity for more uniform application of the rules as far as verifying the signatures that we'll be able to do here by addressing these petitions here at the state level, as opposed to the 36 different interpretations that may have come from the county level. So we think that's going to provide us with a more uniform application of our rules, and also give us the advantage of some efficiencies of being able to do it all here in-house. One of the other things that we're working on, House Bill 3451, which allows the early scanning of the ballots starting at 7 days before the election. Provided that the county has submitted to us a security plan to make sure that everything is secure and accountable. We're in the process right now of finalizing those security plan templates and rules and guidelines, and anticipate that going out to the counties here shortly. Was able to visit with many of the county clerks at their annual conference last week, and so they're excited for this opportunity, and think we'll be able to provide we'll be able to have their security plans reviewed so that they'll be able to take advantage of this new provision of the law. We've also got a big task in front of us for House Bill 2386 with the online voter registration system. And so we're working on that, and have got early development screenshots that we're working with, and trying to work with our vendors and our in-house staff and the counties to make sure that we get the system in a usable form. And we realize that we've got a short time frame to get this implemented, and we will. And we're building it with the opportunity to be able to scale it and make it more streamlined and easier to use in the future as we learn as we go through this process. And then the final thing that I wanted to talk about was our fax voting, House Bill 2511, and we've actually got a form that's ready, and we can share those with you so that voters that are overseas in the military have the opportunity to fax in their ballot, and so this form allows them to work with their county to be able to for them to get a ballot and be able to sign the waiver so that we can see their ballot when it comes through, because obviously it violates their secrecy of the ballot. But by them completing this form, we're able to accept that ballot, and so that more of our overseas voters can have their ballots counted and processed here in a timely manner. So with that, I look forward to working with the committee. I'm sure I will see you in February and in future times, and I'm happy to be here.
Mr. Chair, if I may, a couple of quick additions before questions. Just on the early scanning bill and the fax voting bill that you all passed earlier this year. We are moving forward in a timely way with the adoption of rules and these sorts of forms and such, anticipating that there might be an election in January, and both bills would take effect for an election that occurs after January 1. So we want to make sure that these provisions are available both to the voters and to our counties. So if there is an election in January, our military and overseas voters will be able to fax in their ballots for that election, and counties will be able to start scanning early, assuming they have a security plan that's been approved by our office. And I had a meeting with a large number of county clerks shortly after the session, and I would say a majority of those present expressed an interest in starting to scan early for a January election if there is one, viewing it as a good test run since there's only a couple of issues on that ballot. And then just two other quick issues. Couple of issues that came up last session. One was the cost of elections and the sharing of those costs among various municipalities. And I had pledged to you that we would begin a conversation in the interim, and that conversation is beginning. We're convening a meeting on Friday of this week with all the counties and cities and special districts and our office, and we'll start that conversation. We look forward to updating you at your convenience in January. And there was another little bill that came to mind as you were discussing redistricting. It was House Bill 3237, which made a number of changes in a broad relating clause bill. One in particular, though, affected our counties, which was the drawing of precincts after redistricting. And the bill that ended up passing, although it's not operative until after the redistricting plan, does cause them a lot of heartache in that they are looking at having to create a number of island precincts within a district, and that affects the number of ballot styles, a number of extra work. And so we are meeting also on Friday with the proponents of that portion of the bill to see if we can't come up with a solution that we can bring to you in February that solves the heartache for the counties but still gets the proponents some of what they were looking for out of the bill.
And in that light, that may be one of those that we consider at some point as a committee bill, if they can get that stuff worked out. So just thought, bring that to the point, too. Questions? Representative Girard.
I apologize to Steve because you haven't been here long enough to really. But in anticipation of knowing I was going to be up here, I'm going to file for re-election. I downloaded the form and found that it was from 2008. Barry, you just shrugged your shoulders and
supported. No, I smiled. Okay.
But I'm just wondering, how many are we up to date? Are we getting up to date? Or what's the plan to get the proper forms online for people?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Girard, I'm going through that every day as I learn the different forms and trying to figure out what our status is. I know our staff is working hard on the number of manuals and forms that we have to be ready to reflect the law changes from the last session. And those are continuing, and I'm reviewing those as fast as they come in on my desk. But I will follow up and continue as I learn the new forms and all of the different publications that we have and forms to find out diligently what their status is and make sure that we keep them as up to date and as simple and easy to use as we can.
Welcome to Oregon.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, too, if I may follow up. The all of the forms and manuals routinely get updated in January 1 of the even-numbered year, because typically that's when all of your election law changes take effect. And so that's why we are in the process of updating those fields. I did contact all the four caucus offices to let them know that if they had questions coming in around that it was okay to use the 2008 forms, that the dates that were on there didn't matter. The required information was still current and would still work.
Thank you.
Representative Hannah.
Steve, welcome. You might take a look at your new form, the fourth sentence or the warning down there.
Okay.
Check out the fourth word.
Spell check. Welcome to Oregon, indeed.
Check. It was just a quick one. How about voter integrity? What do you have going on? Anything new in terms of voter integrity?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hannah, there's obviously we've got new rules for petition circulators as part of House Bill 2005, and then we've also got new investigators in our office to be able to go out into the field and pursue pursue those actions. We're in the process right now of hiring two of those full-time investigators that will be in our staff. And then you may be referring to the other investigators that we have out there as part of the pilot program for this year that's been out reviewing the petition circulators for any petition that's on the street between now and the end of the year. Mm-hmm. We do have investigators out there on the street. They continue to be out there, and we are gathering information and reports from them on a regular basis so that we can come back to you and submit that report to give you our findings and figure out what the best next steps are.
Okay. Paul?
Yeah.
Literally, I was going down the line more of, ballots that have been cast by people who have been dead for years. Those type of voter integrity issues where, over the years, there's certainly been a group of people out there diligently digging through those kind of records. I've written letters myself to the Secretary of State's office talking about how are we checking that and what are we doing about that. Can you address that just a little bit?
Sure. And Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanna, I thank you for that clarification. And we have a tight review of the voter rolls and work at continually updating that and making sure it's as current as possible based on the information that we have. We're working closely with the state of Washington to make sure that there's no duplicates there, and if there's any dead voters on the rolls either here or there, that we're able to pull those off the rolls. I'm still learning all of the steps and all of the resources we have to keep at bay of that. But I think the centralized voter registration database is a big tool in our behalf to be able to have all of those records centralized and in one place so that we have better access to sort out duplicates and to be able to monitor any problems that may arise.
Great. Thank you. Representative Berger.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Trout, I welcome to Oregon and welcome to Salem. If you settle in Salem, I'd be happy to help you and your family in any way. If you go to Silverton or somewhere, well, I'll have to pass you off. But that's okay. I'm not worried about Klamath Falls.
That's where I was last week.
I have an issue that I had a discussion with your predecessor about, and I hope to pursue, and I just ask you to kind of pay attention as you work through. I mean, you are thrown into the fire here, whoosh, and that I think you'll find that there are fires constantly in this state on elections issues, so get used to the fire.
That's why there's rain.
Yeah, that may be. But I have one that's high on my issues that I would like to see at some point when you have had a chance to see how the current system works and in working with the members of this committee and my chair, and that is the function that is currently in statute of the Secretary of State's Elections Division to audit CNE reports. I think the system is complicated. It doesn't serve anybody very well. It causes a lot of bureaucracy and it doesn't, as it should, really enhance our election process. The juice isn't really worth the squeeze, in my opinion. And so I would like to think that this committee and in conjunction with you could come up with some streamlining of this that would retain the sense that we're audited, but not cost so many people working on this in your shop that are not working on what I consider to be really more important fires that need a lot of personnel. I think it's just personnel costly and doesn't get us where we'd like to. So I see my good chair nodding, and so when you have time, I'd like to discuss that for future legislative changes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, if I may just remind you, we did actually pass some changes to the auditing.
Yes, they were minor, in my opinion.
So I would encourage the conversation to continue after we've tried the new rules and new process. If it's still burdensome with you, we would love to have that conversation.
Thank you.
Other questions? I guess the other one, that at some point, either come back or individually let people know. We had a lot of discussion on the idea of allowing the early voting, the early counts in the counties. And the security plan was an essential part to make sure that we really understood it was going to work. At some point, I think we'd like to review to see what that really entails and what's happening so that we feel comfortable with it. I know that part of the discussion at the other time was you don't want to let everything out because part of the security is not understanding what we're doing. So we accept that, and we really do. I trust the fact that you've got the county and state working together to make this happen, and both would like it to work. So they are invested in making it work. But to make sure that we're all confident that we don't get the blow up at some point that says, you know, I don't think that was correct, to keep that level of assurance with respect to people over time, as you think that things would be appropriate to let us know that it's happening, I would love to see what's happening there, just my own personal one. Because it was a stretch for a lot of people on this committee when we passed that, that we were going to do that. And we took a lot on faith because the county people came and really made a strong case of why it would be important. We saw the things that happen when machines break down that night and all the other kind of stuff happens. So a lot of people want it to work, but we also want to make sure that it's a real secure environment. So, other questions? Thank you, and welcome to Oregon. It is it's great to have you here. You're going to, we can all say that right now. You know, you're going to get a lot of other kinds of comments, and as time goes on, because you're in a position, as Representative Berger pointed out, that a lot of people are going to watch everything you do over and over and over again. And I hope that more people can take advantage of what Representative Nolan did and go down and see what's happening with the count. I think that would be good. And I know that we did get that invitation earlier, and I've been looking at my calendar to try to figure out time I could slip over to see what's going on. But thank you. Yes,
Mr. Chair. On that note, if any of you would like to take a tour of the verification process, please just call my office, and we'll arrange a time while you're here over the next day or so. And also, I would encourage you in January. We'll probably be contacting you and encouraging you to come out to your county clerks during the vote tallying process, so you can see for yourself sort of the both the process and procedures and some of the security measures. So we'll be setting that up, and I hope that you will all take advantage of that.
That's a great idea.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you both.
And it always seems like we have an opportunity to have a conversation about our ethics. So, Mr. Burson, if you want to come up, we would love to hear your take on the things that we did this last session. And,
I live in Kaiser. Does that count?
Yeah, you're close enough.
All right.
Yeah, that's true.
Thank you, Chair Wilbland, and members of the committee. My name is Ron Burson. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. And I was given the opportunity to come down here and talk about what we did last session. So, and where the agency's at in implementing those changes. In the 2009 session, we passed two major bills with that had to do with the Oregon government ethics laws. That was Senate Bill 30 and House Bill 2518. And I'll go over these changes that were made and the effects that they have. And if you have any questions, if you just want to ask me at any time, that's fine. First of all, the listing of relatives and members of household on the annual verified statement of economic interest is no longer required. And at the same time, the staff was given the requirement to redact any listings of relatives from prior filings. So, in other words, if somebody has a public records request, we will redact the information that was filed in the prior year when it was required. Also, along that same quarterly public disclosure reports, the quarterly reports that were for certain items under the Statement of Economic Interest, those were also eliminated in the 2009 session. That information is still included, but it will be included in your annual report. It will not be filed quarterly. Public school employees may accept reasonable expenses paid to them for accompanying students on educational trips. In the past, there was an exception for teachers to travel with their students, and this allows them to accept that gift of travel, food and lodging. Changes were also made to an exception that allows for food, lodging, and travel for acceptance from government entities, Native American tribes, and one of the big ones was not-for-profits, 501c3s. Before 2009, that 501c3 was required to receive less than 5% of its funding from for-profit corporations. After the change, that less than 5% from for-profit corporations was eliminated. So you can accept food, lodging, and travel from a 501c3 attending, and there were several of them. And one of them was a convention, and you have to be representing yourself in your official capacity. So now I will caution you that those trips now are reportable on that annual statement of economic interest if you are an SEI filer. The big change that happened in 2009 was the definition of legislative administrative interest under the gift provisions. Prior to 2009, legislative administrative interest was in the agency that you work for, the government entity that you work for. Now that interest is in the decision or vote of the person that holds that office. And as you know, this is a major change for us in determining legislative administrative interest, which is kind of, if you're going to flow chart this, that's the first yes or no. And if it's yes, then we're going to get into the gift provisions and any kind of exceptions. If it's no legislative administrative interest, there are no limits to the gifts. So if you do not have a legislative administrative interest. Excuse me. So people will ask the agency, what is decision or vote? Well, vote's fairly easy. If you vote, if you're going to vote on something, you have an interest in that. It gets more difficult under decision. The agency is currently, it should come out on October 1st in the Oregon Bulletin. We have proposed administrative rules. They're currently being reviewed by our legal counsel, but legislative administrative interest and a definition of legislative administrative interest is included in those rules. And just to kind of sum it up, what we're looking at is if in your position as a public official, any decisions you make and the people that are affected by those decisions, you would have an interest in those. But decisions or people outside of that bubble or that outside of your authority, out of your decision-making authority, you would not have an interest. So, a simple example. Earlier in my career when I was a revenue agent for the Department of Revenue, yeah, I've always been popular.
Great training for your current position.
True. But, as a revenue agent for the Department of Revenue, people would say, I really didn't have any decision-making authority. I mean, I was way down in the organizational chart. But the truth of the matter is that I made a lot of decisions. I decided how much you paid, how I could write off part of your tax debt if it was deemed necessary. We had waivers of penalties and interest that come about. And so obviously I wouldn't be able to accept gifts from people that I was working. A tax auditor, we would not want them accepting gifts from people that they're going to audit their taxes. So that's kind of the model that we're looking at in this rule. And I would encourage everyone, when they do come out, we will, be providing those to you folks, but to please offer comments to the commission before the November 20th date when we plan on voting on those rules. So another change is a public official may accept admission, food, and beverage when attending a reception. Now, that was always the case, but what was eliminated in 2009 was the requirement to speak or answer questions as part of the program. In our rules, it's allowed, I'm sorry, by attending reception, meal, or meeting. We have determined, reception, meal, or meeting held by an organization, we have determined this does not include a one-on-one meal. It is a meal meeting from an organization. So, but you are not required to speak at that reception, meal, or meeting. Another big change that happened in 2009 was the addition of a gift exception that allowed the acceptance of gifts that was part of usual and customary practice of the public official's private business or employment. It's you folks being part-time public officials in many cities and counties. The city councils are volunteer, and you know the mayor may own a business in town. You know, there's always been that difficulty in drawing the line between when am I the mayor or when am I the business owner. So if I own the hardware store and the person that sells hammers has always given me, you know, a complimentary hammer when I do my yearly order, and now I'm the mayor, can I still take that complimentary hammer? This exception would allow for that to happen. And it's another one that we were defining in rules, but it's an awful difficult one for the agency to come up with all the examples. We're going to put some examples in our rule to try to give some people some guidance, but it's awful difficult for the agency to determine what's usual and customary in everybody's business in this state. So the burden goes back onto the public official to know what is usual and customary. And where that'll come about is if somebody complains to the agency, that is a question we will ask them. You know, they've always received the hammer every year. And, another change that happened in 2009, entertainment, the total prohibition on entertainment, that was eliminated. Entertainment now is part of the $50 gift limit. So you are allowed to take $50 in gifts from any source in a calendar year, which now that $50 does include entertainment. Another change that happened was the definition of candidate was added to 244.0204, so the definition of candidate was brought into some of the ethics laws as required. Other changes that happened to the annual verified statement of economic interest is we've always had some confusion around how to report income. In the past, we had two different categories. You had to report income that was between 10 and 49% of your income, and then income over 50%. And then we had, the last time, we had the five most significant sources of income. So the agency got a lot of calls, as I know you folks did too, and what is significant? You know, if I don't know, if I pick up bottles alongside the road, we actually got that question, is that a significant source of income? You know, and I don't know if it is for that person or
not. What kind of bottles?
So,
me it is.
So, yeah. we made a change to hopefully simplify this. So now you will report all income above 10%, so of your total income. So anything that's below 10% of your total income, you will not be required to report. The listing of food, lodging, and travel expenses under the F and H exception. The F exception is basic exception from government entities, that 501c3 that I talked about, and the H exception is from private industry. Those will need to be reported onto the annual verified statement of economic interest. The last one is there was the listing of sources of income over $1,000 from a source having legislative administrative interest and does business with the government agency. That will be listed on the statement of economic interest. So if you do business with somebody and you accepted income over $1,000 and that business does business with your agency, you will report that. So. That is my update. I talked a little bit about the administrative rules. We were on track to have the administrative rules operative on January 1st. Hopefully we'll have those out for people to look at here pretty quickly as soon as they're reviewed by our legal counsel to make sure that I haven't written anything that I shouldn't have written in there. What's the other thing I was going to talk about? We have got some calls about the commission funding. I thought I would talk about that for a bit. I'm sure you folks are going to ask me a question about it. In 2007, the commission's funding was changed from a general fund agency to another funds agency. And during that 2007 session, we worked with, and I think Senate Rules worked with, the associations for Oregon counties, the League of Oregon Cities, the Special District Association, and try to come up with a funding model for the agency. We were trying to look for some kind of independent funding model that got away from general fund and basically got away from the ebbs and flows of the general fund. And what came out was a funding model that we would spread the funding of the agency throughout state government and throughout local government. It was determined in 2009 that state government would pay half of the agency's funding and local government would pay the other half of the agency's funding. I would like to point out that in local government, there's over 1,700 entities that have gotten assessed. The assessments went out in mid-July. Those payments are being made now. Some people had questions about that. They contacted the agency. Some people would rather not pay that. We talked to them about the assessment. We also informed them that we're not asking for something for free. The other thing that we were allowed to have in the 2009 legislature was an additional trainer position. And so if you get an assessment out there, I just say this for all your constituents, and you don't think you're getting your money's worth, you give me a call and we'll have somebody out there, we'll get your people trained. Because the last thing that I'd like to see at my commission meetings is these folks that come before the commission that forgot to declare a conflict of interest. Is a simple, just as an example. They didn't declare a conflict of interest. If they declared the conflict of interest, there would not have been a violation. And the reason they didn't declare it is because they didn't know they had to. And so we need to stop that kind of behavior or that kind of mistake out there. And so we will be providing, we have not turned anybody down for training, no matter where they're at in this state. We are also working very hard right now to develop online training for folks so that they have access to these different types of training online. And today I was able to offer a position to the new trainers, so hopefully they haven't got back to me when they can start, but hopefully by mid-month they will be in the agency. So,
just a question on that one. That fee is based on audited amount of money that the agency has. How do you base the fee that goes to each?
The fees to local government is based on the municipal audit fee. And the Secretary of State's office can probably talk about the municipal audit fee better than I can, but essentially there are 8 levels of that fee, and the bottom level, I understand, is entities that have less than $50,000 of expenditure. The top level is over $50 million in expenditure, and so they pay the Secretary of State's to audit their budgets for the year. I mean, they look at that, and that's a fee that they pay. So this is based on that fee. So in this assessment out there, the level number one, the lowest level for the biennium, would pay $67.32. The largest level, which would be something like the City of Portland, Multnomah County, Marion County, would pay $1,346.35 for the biennium to fund the agency. So by having 1,700 different entities to go to, it spreads it out quite a bit. Now, on the other half, the state, they pay on a per FTE basis. So whatever their FTE was, they are given a per FTE basis on that. And those have been collected this biennium.
Mr. Chair. And Mr. Burson, FTE includes paid staff as well as volunteer public officials like commission members and things like that, because those are the folks you serve.
Chair Roblin, Representative Nolan, full-time equivalent, FTE, I apologize for the acronym. My understanding is that is paid personnel. That is what they are asking for in their budget. That is the number that is being used. So in our agency, we have 7 FTE. We do not include the 7 members of the commission.
Okay. It basically was just a formula derived at to spread it out. So, yeah.
Right.
Other questions? Have you heard, I mean, generally in your business, good news is you don't hear anything. So
that's true.
I haven't checked necessarily with schools. I know we heard a lot from them earlier. I haven't checked to see if they have more trips starting up again, if that's going whatever. Have they been checking on if there's anything they need to do?
Representative Roblin, yes, they have. I think one of the things that was done very well in 2518 was the idea of making that an emergency clause instead of waiting for January 1st. And there were some other things that were also emergency clauses in this that people have asked us questions about. But the school districts and teachers have asked us about this exception, and we've given them advice on that informal basis that we're able to do that.
Okay, good. Other questions? Thank you very much.
All right, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Wrong agenda. ...2010 possible committee bills. As you know, the way we're doing this right now is that we each get one as members, but committees can have others if we get approval. So there have been a group, you heard one today from the Secretary of State's office asking about a clarification there that might be helpful, if the counties and them can work it out with some people. There may be a few others, and as we get going, the first one that I actually put on the list, and you have a copy of the bill, was a bill from last session, which was 3223, and so I put a copy of that bill. It was requested, and I'm trying to remember. I'll figure that one out. We'll talk about it more at the next session, because I think we're filling up the final rules for that session in the next couple days. But I just thought, as we have done in this committee from the very beginning, no secrets. We just put stuff out there as people, as it comes to me, and as I look forward to working with this committee to let people see, and I'll give you a chance to look that over as time goes on. But it gets it started. So if you have other things that you think would be helpful, I don't have any problem in contacting the speaker and seeing what we can do as a committee. Yes, Representative Berger.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just before this committee started, I went down to Legislative Council to get some clarification on a couple of bills, one of which came out of this committee, and it was the public contracting bill. Do you remember working that?
Yep.
There's some question we exempted out transportation districts, but what about cities who contract their transportation, their bus service, was the question. I've got it down at Ledge Council to ask what their opinion is on this, and depending on what they say, I might propose clarification or something in that bill.
Yeah, and to me, that's from my perspective, if there are things that need to be in the time between the last session and the next session in bills that we passed that need little fixes, those are good things for committee bills. I mean, if we can come to agreements on things where unintended consequences have happened, and most of you have never probably had a problem with an unintended consequence, but I've had a few in my career. And so if it pops itself up, for me, the whole idea of the trips for teachers and kids going to Europe stuff was an unintended consequence of the previous bill, and it was important from my perspective to get that dealt with. If we can do that, I think committee bills are a good place to have that happen. So let's have that conversation as we get closer. Any other issues that we have before us? We did put public comment, and we didn't get anybody signed up. There's nobody out there that wants to come up here, and they haven't. We've been away for so long, I would have thought that all of you would want your chance to come speak in front of the Rules Committee. One of the things that has impressed me over the last number of years that I've been here is the quality of the staff that we get, and I think that continues to be something that we should be proud of, that we continue to build some real professional staff members, and Beth is one of those that I've had the opportunity to work with, and I hope that as committee members, if you have questions, you don't hesitate to use that expertise and answer questions and get stuff to her. It helps the committee work well as well, and I appreciate the fact that they're willing to do and help with everybody and do the things that they need to do to make this place function and run well. So encourage you to use the people who we have here to help make this whole process work well for all of us. And with that, unless there's anything else, we're going to be right on schedule. Pretty good, Beth. See, that was really good, Beth.
Ooh, that was masterful.
So with that, we're going to adjourn the Rules Committee for today. Thank you.